a fire ship left the shore a couple of days ago. Spacious part of the ocean. Maybe you can barely see the shore we left. Can't see the shore where we're going yet either. Just adrift in the ocean of Buddha nature. Some days it's windy and stormy. Some days it's windless. So windless that our sails are just flopping around and we're going nowhere. What a strange thing we do to sit here day after day. As we just chanted, may the great earth and all living beings together attain the Buddha way. Can the great earth planet of dirt and rock attain the Buddha way? With us? I don't think it could attain the Buddha way without us. But can a non-sentient being like Earth realize the Buddha way? Does the great Earth have Buddha nature? So we talked about this a little yesterday, where Dogen says, as for all living beings in the Buddha way, all things possessed of mind are called living beings. All things that have a mind are living beings. Because mind is, as such, living being. Pretty straightforward. And then he says, things not possessed of mind are also living beings, because living beings are, as such, mind. That's not so straightforward, but that's what Dogen says. Things not that don't have mind are also living beings. Hence, all mind is living being, and living beings are all being Buddha nature. This is all Dogen's comment on the saying, all living beings have Buddha nature. But he's defining living beings here to include things without mind. And then, even more explicitly, he says, grass and trees, nations and states are mind. Because they are mind, they are living being. Because they are living being, they are being Buddha nature. Sun, moon, stars and planets are mind. Because they are mind, they are living being. Because they are living being, they are being Buddha nature. If it were not like this, it would not be the being Buddha nature that is uttered in the Buddha way. And I propose that everything we experience, the things of the world, the dirt and rocks of the great earth, are mental projections, the way we experience them. And therefore, their mind. Right? It looks like a wooden stick, but I'm just experiencing my mental projection of the wooden stick, and therefore it's, strictly speaking, mind. And we have this teaching that the nature of mind, the nature of all aspects of mind, the nature of even mental projections, the true nature of mental projections is Buddha nature. Therefore, the true nature of the stick is Buddha nature. But it helps to make that little link and say, first we see the stick as a mental projection, the way we're experiencing it. And then we say that mental projection of the stick, the true nature of that projection is unhindered, compassionate, wise Buddha nature. Or Buddha nature is empty awareness, free of all fixed reference points. It looks like a fixed reference point here, but the true nature of the stick is not a fixed reference point, but it's the way that the mind is projecting it, and the nature of the mind is empty of mental projection, and that's what we call Buddha nature. So Dogen doesn't say all that, but I then found this saying. This is a long article by Robert Scharf up at UC Berkeley on the Buddha nature of insentient things. And it's a whole quite extensive history of this teaching of Buddha nature of non-sentient things. It wasn't like a one-time thing. It was a whole movement in ancient China, and how exactly that thought evolved. Because actually in the Parinirvana Sutra that Dogen continuously quotes through his Buddha nature teaching, he quotes it because it keeps speaking of Buddha nature. In that sutra, it says something like rocks, tiles, pebbles, and walls. This phrase that we often bring up as expressing Buddha activity maybe came from the sutra. But in the sutra, it says these things like rocks, tiles, and pebbles are non-sentient, so they don't have Buddha nature. The sutra says is clarifying what Buddha nature is. It's all living beings with mind have Buddha nature, or the nature of mind is Buddha nature, but rocks, tiles, and pebbles don't have this. That's what the sutra says. So then people began questioning this sutra. So Chan Master Nanyang Hui Chung, who actually Dogen quotes several times and praises this particular Zen teacher. He quotes him in "This Very Mind is Buddha," Shobogenzo Sokushin Zebutsu, and other places too. But here's a little conversation that I don't think Dogen ever quotes. A student asked Hui Zhong, national teacher Hui Zhong, what is the meaning of the saying, the mind of an old Buddha? And Hui Zhong said, insentient things such as walls, fences, tiles, and stones are all the mind of an old Buddha. The student said, but this is at odds with the scriptures. The Parinirvana Sutra says, everything apart from insentient things such as walls, fences, tiles, and stones is called Buddha nature. Everything apart from these non-sentient things is called Buddha nature. Now, you say that all insentient things are the mind of Buddha, but you have yet to consider the relationship between mind and nature. Are they different or not? Mind and the nature of mind, or mind and Buddha nature. Wei Jung said, to the deluded they are different, to the enlightened they are not different. The student said, but this also contradicts the scriptures. It said in a scripture, in a sutra, the Buddha said, oh good disciple of Buddha, mind is not Buddha nature. Buddha nature is eternal, while mind is not eternal. Mind is impermanent. I don't know if that was the Parinirvana Sutra, but that's a kind of standard Mahayana teaching. The nature of mind doesn't come and go, but mind itself is constantly rising and ceasing, impermanent, changing. Mind and the nature of mind are always right together. We can't actually separate mind and its nature, just like we can't separate form and emptiness. But there are two different words. We talk about the form side and the emptiness side, the mind side and the nature of mind side. And it looks like the Buddha says in this sutra, mind is not Buddha nature, because Buddha nature is unchanging, eternal, while mind is constantly arising and ceasing. The student goes on to say, now you say they're not different, teacher. How do you intend to explain yourself? Hui Jung said, you rely on the words rather than on the meaning. So, it literally says this in the sutra, but let's take a look more deeply. It's like a cold winter night when water is bound up as ice. When warm weather comes, the ice melts back into water. When sentient beings are deluded, their nature is bound up as mind. But when they realize enlightenment, their minds are released again as Buddha nature. I think we brought this up earlier in one of the classes on Buddha nature. Ice and water, same elements, right? Same really. And yet, the free-flowing, ungraspable water that slips through our hand if we try to pick it up can freeze, can contract, and congeal into a fixed, unmoving block of ice. That's quite a nice image, I think, for the relationship of mind and Buddha nature, or sentient beings and Buddhas. Same, really. And yet, sentient beings are temporarily like frozen water. They can't move as freely as the free-flowing river. But I think that Wei Jung says this because that's how we can say that mind and nature are not two. That mind is Buddha nature, even though the words of the sutra say mind is not Buddha nature. And we could say, in a way, ice is not the same as free-flowing water, but we can also say it is really the same. Two different manifestations of water. Huijong goes on to say, if you still maintain that insentient things are without Buddha nature, then the sutras ought not to say that the three realms are mind only, and that the myriad dharmas are only consciousness. Therefore, the Avatamsaka Sutra says that all phenomena of the three realms are produced by mind. Three realms just means every possible experience. Not only our usual mundane realm of desire, but even a very refined absorption states that encompass what we call the three realms of samsaric life are all actually mind. Avatamsaka Sutra says several places in the chapter 26. Now I ask you, Huijong says, do insentient things exist within the triple realm? Or do they exist outside the triple realm? Are they mind or are they not mind? Insentient things like rocks. If they're not mind, then the sutras ought not to say that the triple realm is only mind. If they are mind, the sutras ought not to say that insentient things lack Buddha nature. It's you who contravene the scriptures, not I. So we could actually hear, we could, through this reasoning here, we could say these two sutras contradict each other. It's I think, a wonderful, like, you know, contemplation he's done here. We could say the Mahaparinirvana Sutra says, insentient things don't have Buddha nature, because they don't have mind. Only things with mind have Buddha nature. And then the Avatamsaka Sutra says, well, everything in the three realms, everything non-sentient and sentient, is mind. And therefore, if something is mind, it has Buddha nature. And we have to clarify here that I think this is what Johnny was clarifying yesterday, is that we don't mean that if this stick is mind, that it's like a sentient being, and that it has a mind, or that it senses things. That would be ridiculous, except in some sort of animism or something. But it's a projection of mind. But projections of mind, like all mental factors, in their true nature, are Buddha nature. So projections of mind, we could say, truly are Buddha nature, or using sutra language, have Buddha nature. So this is, I feel like Huijong is making the same type of argument that I was trying to make yesterday. He does it maybe a little more elegantly. Could you follow that? Like, it's a wonderful teaching, and when we hear this thing about non-sentient beings have Buddha nature, instead of just saying, that's just one of those mysterious, weird Zen things, let's just take it on faith, there's some, like, logic here. As I said yesterday, it's combining the mind-only view with the Buddha nature view. Phenomena are actually mental projections, mind, and all the nature of all mental phenomena is Buddha nature. Means, that also, that means maybe the most simply, simple way to put it is, it just means that it's empty, and yet it appears in awareness. Therefore, like a stick is empty of being outside, empty of externality from the mind, and yet it appears, doesn't it, to our mind. Yes.
In astronomy, if a star group or something, or a star is looked at with an optical telescope, it has a certain shape. If it's looked at with infrared telescope, it has a different shape. If it's looked at with an X-ray telescope, it has yet another shape. So that what the star is very different depending upon the instrument that's observing it.
Yeah.
In that way, although it may be very subtle, it may be so subtle that it seems to be the same stick to all of us, we are, in a sense, all different instruments observing the stick. Each stick that we each see is a mental projection of our activity of mind.
Yeah.
We can say that all of those point to the same thing, which is itself ungraspable, but for our purposes, it is useful and communicable.
Yeah, we all create a different stick, slightly different. And we can create these images and believe that they really exist apart from the mind, which we do all the time. And as you know, we've talked about before, like a dream. And but we think this is different than a dream. And if we kind of saw that how we're really projecting basically everything all the time, it might be quite shocking. And I was thinking of, I had this experience like a week ago, my first that I can remember lucid dream. I've been very half-heartedly working with like what they call dream yoga, which is basically trying to become more aware in one's dream life, which I think it's an inspiring opportunity, seems like to me, because we spend so much time asleep and dreaming. It's like, what if we could bring our practice into that realm instead of just letting whatever happens happen? And I personally I consider like a very like bad dreamer in the sense that like I very rarely remember dreams. I know some people who they have never done any of these, they're not even like meditators, but they remember every dream, every night they can tell you in great detail, give you like a 20 minute version of their dream story. I've never been able to do that. I'm envious of those people who can, because it seems so interesting and so rich. And they say that we're dreaming a lot of, not all the night, but a lot of it. And there's various practices to first help remember the dreams and have clear dreams, and then eventually possibly become lucid, which means that you recognize that it's a dream while you're in the dream, and you don't wake up, and your actual waking intentions can function in dream life, which that's how you could practice in a dream, right? But the practices, my life doesn't seem to work very well because I think one of them is like you need to get like enough sleep, and it doesn't work with that. We wake up so early for zazen. Maybe if I went to sleep really early. But sometimes I wake up and I'm starting to remember a dream, and some of the techniques are like, if you don't move at all, don't physically move, because moving like brings you back into your waking life. You can stay there a little longer if you wake up and just don't move, and then try to recall right then as much as you can, and then writing it down also helps, and trying to set the intention before you go to sleep to remember the dreams and recognize them as dreams are all practices. I think particularly that setting the intention is amazing to me. As someone who doesn't dream, if I really wholeheartedly set the intention, I often will remember the dream, which already starts to show how one's waking intention carries over into one's dream world. But as I say, it's very half-hearted. It's an interesting thing that for a while, when I go to sleep, I usually do try to set that intention, but I'm usually really tired and I do it very half-heartedly, just as a matter of form, kind of. So I don't think it was because any particular intention. Although I did set the intention that night. And one of the techniques here too is you do what they call state checks. You can do a state check while you're awake, which is basically like the common one that's used is like in dreams. A common experience people have is being able to fly. I mean, you can do almost anything in a dream intentionally, but that's one that humans like to do because we don't usually fly and we'd like to try it out in a dream. So it's apparently kind of a universal quality of or event in dreams. So a state check is like in waking life, when you're walking throughout the day, you might consider like, I wonder if I'm dreaming now. And then you can check that basically like jumping, just as you're walking along or standing, just jump and see if you fly. And you know, you, if you're in waking life, you don't usually. It's a little check. You get used to doing that in waking life. You just, throughout the day, you just check sometimes. So I have been actually doing that practice for a while, once in a while, and I remember it, especially when things seem kind of dreamy, dreamlike, which sometimes they do, especially sesshin. You can do like, sometimes the question arises, things seem a little strange, and it's kind of like, I wonder if this is a dream. And then you can, you know, let's do a state check. Just jump and like, nope. And sometimes when things are like, especially like dreamlike, I feel so relieved when I do the state check and I don't rise up into the air. Whew. Okay, this is normal. This is regular life here. It's a relief. A little bit, you know, maybe a little part of the mind's like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to fly? It's a relief. Just like, see, this stick really is a stick. It's out here, right? It's over here. It's not my mind. That's very relieving. If I really saw, you know, the mind is completely like projecting this out of the spectrum of Roy G. Biv, of different light rays, of different colors. I think it would be disturbing. This is why it's hard to go there. So anyway, I was standing in the kitchen the other day, Zen Center, a very familiar place to me, and I looked at the door, and the door didn't have a window in it. And the rest of the room was arranged just like it is, and the door was there, but it didn't have a window. And that seemed a little funny, so I like, okay, let's check this out. And I looked over at the little kitchen altar next to the door, and it was there, but it was moved like about half a foot. It was moved, or the placement was a little bit different, enough so that I noticed it, even though it was still there. So it was like kind of normal, but kind of not. And then my mind's, you know, things seem pretty usual, but my mind's thought, this is a little unusual. There must be an explanation for this. And I thought, I think it was like maybe it was Sangha Day or something. I thought, this is probably a construction project going on. Somebody just filled in the window and moved the altar. That explains it. There's always projects going on around Zen Center. Little things are changing. A little light just appeared on the path the other day. And then I thought, the mind was almost settled with that, and then I thought, no, that's just too weird. Like, why would they fill in the window or the door? I never heard about that project happening. They probably would have, you know, somebody would have probably checked or just mentioned anyway. And, you know, I just last time I was in the room, it had a window. So then I thought, that one little question, that wonderful question. Oh, maybe it's a dream. And this is all kind of like pretty quick. And then because of this practice of doing these state checks during the day, this is the first time it's ever happened that I would get that far and then actually remember in the dream, oh yeah, lucid dreaming, right? It's a dream. Because it's so similar to usual, let's do the state check. Jump. And this time, I jumped and I didn't come down, and it completely freaked me out. So this is why I bring this up, because instead of being like, cool, this is a dream, let's go flying, it was very disturbing in the dream. It was like, whoa! And it was not graceful flying, it was very rough, like, kum, 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 kum. And in the dream body, and I don't, maybe real body, I don't know, in the dream body, I clenched up like ice. I gritted my teeth, I clenched my jaw like on a roller coaster when you're going down the first big hill. You can't help but, at least for me, I can't help but clench my teeth like, hold on! It was like that. Whoa! And I floated up the stairs into the second floor. And meanwhile, the mind's kind of assessing this. Oh, wow, okay, this is like a lucid dream, and the state check proved it. and then I was able to keep going for a while in the dream. Very, very vivid and real. And I don't remember what happened, but I remember that it went on for a little while. And then I, you know, gradually and kind of calmly woke up. And when I woke up, I was also pretty freaked out. Like, this is like, I'm not sure if I'm ready to like mess with reality quite like this. It's a little like, a little bit much. And at the same time, I felt like, how wonderful, to question what seems to be totally true in a vivid dream, which some dreams maybe are more vivid than others, but that was like, the kitchen looks just right. Even the altar's there, right? It's just moved over a little bit. And part of the thing is, isn't it amazing that that's like our storehouse consciousness from being in that room, it can construct that room almost exactly the way it is. Maybe the storehouse consciousness has some subtle memory flaws, so it moves the altar over 6 inches, but it's still pretty good. The mind can do that, right? Upstairs in my bed, vivid three-dimensional room. So often dreams get used as a metaphor for the fact that like the stick is not really like a stick, and I think they're good in that way because the mind can create such a world, and it's nice too that dreams have Buddha nature because they're mind. That was a little divergent story. The student then asked Hui Zhong, within the teachings of the sutras, one only sees sentient beings receiving the prophecy of future perfect enlightenment, and then at some future time becoming a Buddha named so-and-so. We hear that in the sutras. The Lotus Sutra has a lot of that. I predict, the Buddha says, that you will be a Buddha named so-and-so. One never sees a non-sentient being receiving the prophecy of future enlightenment and becoming a Buddha. Among the thousand Buddhas of the current Kalpa, if there is a single case of an insentient object becoming a Buddha, please show it to me. He's questioning Huizhong further here. Huizhong said, I now ask you, imagine a prince at the time of his coronation as king. Does the person of the prince receive the kingship all at once, or must every territory in the kingdom be individually bestowed upon him? So, a king of India, say, we now make you the king. You are the ruler of this whole land. But let's start with today, you'll get this state, and then tomorrow you'll get the next state of India, and then eventually you'll have them all. It's like, no, you instantly become the ruler of the entire land, right? The student replied, when the prince is crowned king, everything in the kingdom becomes his. What need is there for him to receive anything else? Huizhong said, the present case is just the same. At the moment when sentient beings, living beings, receive the prophecy of their future Buddhahood, all the lands in the 3,000 great thousandfold worlds are completely subsumed within the Dharmakaya, body of Vairochana Buddha. Beyond the body of the Buddha, how could there still be some non-sentient object to receive the prophecy? Yeah, so, in other words, the whole land of non-sentient beings right now is ours, right? Each of us has our own zendo. We are ruling our own zendo, right? Because we're creating it. Our minds are creating it. And we can look, we can stand on the high tower and look out to the vast horizon. It's all ours, right? It's all our mind, all at once. So, if we are a living being, all of that is mind. Therefore, the nature of all of that land to the farthest horizon has Buddha nature because it's our mind. And when we realize Buddhahood, therefore, the entire land in 10 directions realizes Buddhahood. And realizing Buddhahood, we could say, when Buddha nature is just fully manifest, that includes the whole realm of our experience. This mind-created world becomes, you know, free of all hindrance at the moment we do, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't that make sense? So, in that way, like at the moment of the king receives the entire land, going from an ordinary person to a king, the whole land becomes the kingdom of his at once. Like we say, just Dogen says, even for a moment of Zazen, at this time of Zazen, the whole phenomenal world, the non-sentient realm of world of phenomena, becomes the Buddha's seal, and the entire sky turns into enlightenment. So the whole non-sentient world sits Zazen with us. So I think same point. You know, we hear that sometimes, often hear it in just sort of like this kind of mystical, inconceivable way. But here's a little, you know, still I'd say inconceivable, but here's a little kind of like hint at like the meaning of that, right? Our mind sitting Zazen, like the bell at the clock tower right now, is manifesting our Buddha nature if we hear it. Yeah, just a quick question.
Yeah, it's not a picture of the word subsumed into Dharmakaya. I had this vision of a steel mill putting scrap cars into the big hot pot and everything turning red and gooey. And then later on it becomes another car. Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, hot and gooey in the sense of like inconceivable and indistinguishable, like a mass of fire. Yeah. So maybe something like that. And then manifests as a particular car goes into the fire and comes out at another particular car. So, back to Dogen here. I'm afraid we're going to have to like skip around some here. If I keep going off on tangents. Yeah. And also, you know, we usually say try to avoid reading in Sesshin, but because this has been we're kind of continuing our class series on Buddha nature, if you'd like to read Shobogenzo Busho, to follow this on the breaks, you're welcome to do that. Maybe just that, though. So, meanwhile, Dogen said, one teacher says, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Then he quotes another teacher saying, all sentient beings have no Buddha nature. And that is why, and then he comments on those and continues here, that's why Baijiang said, to teach that sentient beings have Buddha nature is to disparage Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's a 10th Bodhisattva precept, disparaging the three treasures. To teach that sentient beings have Buddha nature is to disparage the three treasures. To teach that sentient beings have no Buddha nature is also to disparage Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And this comes from a longer saying or Baijiang, which I think is just really beautiful Zazen instruction. So here's the whole passage. Speak of having Buddha nature and you disparage the Dharma by attaching to it. Here, this is why, this is the, it disparages the three treasures, and these are the kind of the faults of each one of these things. So if you speak of having Buddha nature, you disparage the Dharma by attaching to it. Teach the existence of Buddha nature, and you disparage it with needless amplification. That it truly exists is amplifying Dharma too much. It's adding a little extra to Dharma. Teach the non-existence of Buddha nature, and you disparage it by reducing it. It's a little too taking away too much. Say it is both existent and non-existent, and you create a discrepancy. Say it is neither existent nor non-existent, and you disparage it with frivolous utterance. That's just like nonsense talk. Endeavor from the first to say nothing at all. That sounds safe, right? But then sentient beings will never reach liberation. Endeavor to teach it from the first, and living beings will attach to your words, and that will give rise to speculation about it. Whatever the case, all these cases, the benefit is small and the harm is great. Hence, Shakyamuni Buddha said, I would rather enter nirvana directly and not teach dharma at all. And yet despite all these admonitions, Dogen says in his commentary, we cannot go without making an utterance. We have to say something. Like that story of the person hanging in the tree by his teeth, and someone comes and says, tell me, does Buddha nature exist or not, for example. And if you open your mouth, you lose your grip on the tree and fall and die. But if you don't say anything, the person's like, I really need help with this. I need to understand. This is the key to my complete freedom. We neglect our bodhisattva duty. So the Buddha said, well, let's give it a shot. Let's go see if someone can understand. Maybe very few people, but I remember those friends that practiced really intensely with me, so intensely that they thought I was getting lazy when I had a few extra grains of rice. Their wholehearted diligence is such that they're close to understanding. And he went and taught them, and one at a time they understood the Buddha's teaching. Amazing. Just think if he hadn't, if he said, this is too subtle and too difficult, no one will ever get it. Let's just enjoy the bliss of nirvana and let Maitreya take care of all these beings in the future. Today is December 8th. Poetic Japanese way of saying December 8th is Rohatsu. This is traditionally the ending day of Rohatsu Sesshin. For us, it's somewhere in the middle of the ocean. So we can celebrate Buddha's realizing the way, Buddha's great awakening, starting now. And then the rest of Sesshin would just be like when the Buddha would hang out around the Bodhi tree before he went off to find his friends to see if he could convey the unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect Dharma. He said, before I do that and get into this whole complicated life of being the Buddha, let's enjoy it for at least a little while without having to say anything, which he did, according to the sutras, for 7 weeks. 7 times 7, maybe the origin of the 7-day sesshin. He did 7 sesshins, each one under a different tree. Buddha nature. Manifesting like a lucid dream. So difficult to find ease flying in this space. so easy to not find difficulty in such a space. So spacious to easily settle into the true nature of difficulty. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.